The fate of Cokeville 1907. Equals link to H40001. I. Cokeville is a little village planted in a cleft in the rocks, 2 leagues from Grandport. A fine sandy beach stretches in front of the huts lodged halfway up in the side of the cliff-like shells left there by the tide. As one climbs to the heights of Grandport, on the left the yellow sheet of sand can be very clearly seen to the west like a river of gold dust streaming from the gaping cleft in the rock, and with good eyes one can even distinguish the houses, whose tones of rust spot the rock and whose chimneys send up their bluish trails to the very crest of the great slope, streaking the sky. It is a deserted hole. Cokeville has never been able to attain to the figure of 200 inhabitants. The gorge which opens into the sea, and on the threshold of which the village is planted, burrows into the earth by turns so abrupt and by descents so steep that it is almost impossible to pass there with wagons. It cuts off all communication and isolates the country so that one seems to be 100 leagues from the neighboring hamlets. Moreover, the inhabitants have communication with Grandport only by water. Nearly all of them fishermen, living by the ocean, they carry their fish there every day in their barks. A great commission house, the firm of Defew, buys their fish on contract. The father Defew has been dead some years, but the widow Defew has continued the business. She has simply engaged a clerk, M. Mouchel, a big blonde devil, charged with beating up the coast and dealing with the fishermen. This M. Mouchel is the sole link between Cokeville and the civilized world. Cokeville merits a historian. It seems certain that the village, in the night of time, was founded by the Mice, a family which happened to establish itself there and which grew vigorous at the foot of the cliff. These Mice continued to prosper at first, marrying continually among themselves, for during centuries one finds none but Mice there. Then under Louis XIII appeared one Floche. No one knew too much of where he came from. He married a Mae, and from that time a phenomenon was brought forth. The Floches in their turn prospered and multiplied exceedingly, so that they ended little by little in absorbing the Mice, whose numbers diminished until their fortune passed entirely into the hands of the newcomers. Without doubt, the Floches brought new blood, more vigorous physical organs, a temperament which adapted itself better to that hard condition of high wind and of high sea. At any rate, they are today masters of Cokeville. It can easily be understood that this displacement of numbers and of riches was not accomplished without terrible disturbances. The Mice and the Hoshes detest each other. Between them is a hatred of centuries. The Mice, in spite of their decline, retain the pride of ancient conquerors. After all, they are the founders, the ancestors. They speak with contempt of the first Floche, a beggar, a vagabond picked up by them from feelings of pity, and to have given away one of their daughters to whom was their eternal regret. This Floche, to hear them speak, had engendered nothing but a descent of libertines and thieves, who pass their nights in raising children and their days in coveting legacies. And there is not an insult they do not heap upon the powerful tribe of Floche, seized with that bitter rage of nobles, decimated, ruined, who see the spawn of the bourgeoisie master of their rents and of their chateau. The Floches, on their side, naturally have the insolence of those who triumph. They are in full possession, a thing to make them insolent. Full of contempt for the ancient race of the Mice, they threaten to drive them from the village if they do not bow their heads. To them they are starvelings, who instead of draping themselves in their rags would do much better to mend them. So Cokeville finds itself a prey to two fierce factions, something like 130 inhabitants bent upon devouring the other 50 for the simple reason that they are the stronger. The struggle between two great empires has no other history. Among the quarrels which have lately upset Cokeville, they cite the famous enmity of the brothers, Fouas and Toupain, and the ringing battles of the Rouge et Ménage. You must know that every inhabitant in former days received a surname, which has become today the regular name of the family, for it was difficult to distinguish oneself among the cross-breedings of the Mice and the Floches. Rouge assuredly had an ancestor of fiery blood. As for Fouas and Toupain, they were called thus without knowing why, many surnames having lost all rational meaning in course of time. Well, old Françoise, a wanton of 80 years who lived forever, had had Fouas by a Mae, then becoming a widow, she remarried with a Floche and brought forth Toupain. Hence the hatred of the two brothers, made specially lively by the question of inheritance. At the Rouges they beat each other to a jelly because Rouge accused his wife, Marie, of being unfaithful to him for a Floche, the tall Brissimont, a strong, dark man, on whom he had already twice thrown himself with a knife, yelling that he would rip open his belly. Rouge, a small, nervous man, was a great spitfire. But that which interested Cokeville most deeply was neither the tantrums of Rouge nor the differences between Toupain and Fouas. A great rumor circulated: Delphine, a Mae, a rascal of 20 years, dared to love the beautiful Margot, the daughter of Locke Hugh, the richest of the flushes and chief man of the country. This Locke was, in truth, a considerable personage. They called him Locke because his father, in the days of Louis-Philippe, had been the last to tie up his hair, with the obstinacy of old age that clings to the fashions of its youth. Well, then, Locke owned one of the two large fishing smacks of Coqueville, the Zephyr, by far the best, still quite new and seaworthy. The other big boat, the Baleine, a rotten old patache, one, belonged to Rouget, whose sailors were Delphine and Fouas, while Locke took with him Toupain and Brissimont. These last had grown weary of laughing contemptuously at the Baleine, a sabot, they said, which would disappear some fine day under the billows like a handful of mud. So when Locke learned that that ragamuffin of a Delphine, the froth of the Baleine, allowed himself to go prowling round his daughter, he delivered two sound whacks at Margot, a trifle merely to warn her that she should never be the wife of a Maillet. As a result, Margot, furious, declared that she would pass that pair of slaps onto Delphine if he ever ventured to rub against her skirts. It was vexing to be boxed on the ears for a boy whom she had never looked in the face. One naval term signifying a rickety old concern. Margot, at 16 years strong as a man and handsome as a lady, had the reputation of being a scornful person, very hard on lovers. And from that, added to the trifle of the two slaps, of the presumptuousness of Delphine, and of the wrath of Margot, one ought easily to comprehend the endless gossip of Coqueville. Notwithstanding, certain persons said that Margot, at bottom, was not so very furious at sight of Delphine circling round her. This Delphine was a little blonde, with skin bronzed by the sea glare, and with a mane of curly hair that fell over his eyes and in his neck. And very powerful despite his slight figure, quite capable of thrashing anyone three times his size. They said that at times he ran away and passed the night in Grandport. That gave him the reputation of a Veuve with the girls, who accused him, among themselves, of making a life of it, a vague expression in which they included all sorts of unknown pleasures. Margot, when she spoke of Delphine, betrayed too much feeling. He, smiling with an artful air, looked at her with eyes half shut and glittering, without troubling himself the least in the world over her scorn or her transports of passion. He passed before her door, he glided along by the bushes watching for her hours at a time, full of the patience and the eye cunning of a cat lying in wait for a tomtit, and when suddenly she discovered him behind her skirts, so close to her at times that she gasped it by the warmth of his breath, he did not fly, he took on an air gentle and melancholy which left her abashed, stifled, not regaining her wrath until he was some distance away. Surely, if her father saw her he would smite her again. But she boasted in vain that Delphine would some day get that pair of slaps she had promised him. She never seized the moment to apply them when he was there, which made people say that she ought not to talk so much, since in the end she kept the slaps herself. No one, however, supposed she could ever be Delphine's wife. In her case they saw the weakness of a coquette. As for a marriage between the most beggarly of the mess, a fellow who had not six shirts to set up housekeeping with, and the daughter of the mayor, the richest heiress of the Flushes, it would seem simply monstrous. Evil tongues insinuated that she could perfectly go with him all the same, but that she would certainly not marry him. A rich girl takes her pleasure as it suits her, only, if she has a head, she does not commit a folly. Finally all Coqueville interested itself in the matter, curious to know how things would turn out. Would Delphine get his two slaps? Or else Margot, would she let herself be kissed on both cheeks and somehow